Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today I have two guests. John Adlam is a group psychotherapist and independent researcher, a founder member of the Association for Psychosocial Studies. He lives in South London and he works for the NHS, where he's a consultant adult forensic psychotherapist at the Bethlehem Royal Hospital and principal adult psychotherapist at Springfield Hospital. And we have Chris Scanlon, an independent psychosocial researcher and consultant. He's a training group analyst at the Institute of Group Analysis and at the Irish Group Analytic Society. And he's associate lecturer at the Professional Doctorate Programme at the Tavistock Centre and a founder member and board member of the Association for Psychosocial Studies. Together, they have written a book recently published called Psychosocial Explorations of Trauma, Exclusion and Violence: Unhoused Minds and Inhospitable Environments. John and Chris, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Can I ask you to start, John, and just tell us a bit about this book? I got very interested in it. It sounds like it addresses some challenging problems.
Yeah, well, thank you, Sam. This book is about fraught encounters in public spaces between the power of in-groups and the plight of out-groups. I think that's the headline. And we are looking at processes that usually come under the heading of kind of social exclusion, social inclusion, but taking a what we think of as a psychosocial approach, a sort of psychosocial studies approach, which we can say something about, to relations of power and domination between in-groups and out-groups that get expressed and materialized and not often metabolized at the edge, at the interface, at the intersection between these different kind of states and groups.
And are you focusing on any particular marginalized groups, mentally ill, homelessness, or is it kind of a broad spectrum of the marginalized?
We started our long kind of journey of writing together, thinking about what gets constructed as the problem of homelessness, which we see as the problem of how we, the housed, unseat the unhoused. But I think I would say about this book that it's looking at that dynamic as it plays out everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the book is like only 200 pages, so it doesn't sort of cover every kind of version of this that gets played out. But we're thinking about housedness and settledness, and unhousedness and unsettledness as it manifests in all sorts of different ways. But homelessness, yes. Climate disaster, yes. Human mobility, yes. Racism and racialization, yes. But we kind of try and cover lots of ground, but looking at this dynamic wherever we look.
Thanks. And Chris, what would you add to that? What do you want to share?
The thing about the book title, so if we go back to the title, the interesting thing is, I think that both John and I wanted it to be called Unhoused Minds and Inhospitable Environments, because in a way that captures what we're trying to think about, which is the way in which, you know, minds, people's minds, and they become unhoused and split off from and excluded from the conversation, if you like, by the environment, the inhospitable environment. So in a way, I would say that the book's about unhoused minds and inhospitable environments and what that means. I think, as John says, you know, that in a way, if you think about the most inhospitable of environments at the moment, It's the way in which humankind is, you know, unhousing ourselves, if you like, in relation to climate change, and that manifests itself in the ways in which the mass migration across the world unhouses particular people as a consequence of climate change, which then leads to, you know, slogans about, you know, stop the boats in relation to migration. In the UK, for instance, building walls in, you know, in Mexico, in America, for instance. And so in a way, the subtitle, we would have had it as then saying this is about violence, trauma and exclusion.
Yeah.
Because in a way, that's sort of what we're doing. But clinically, and in terms of our original sort of work together, it was very much around people whose history of traumatization and traumatic processes in childhood, for instance, had led to them becoming violent or displaced or homeless or self-harming or, you know, whatever it was. So in a way, we're using the sort of the allegory of homelessness to encompass, you know, the personal, the interpersonal, the community, the social and the global as a sort of parallel way of understanding the same phenomenon, which is trauma, violence and exclusion.
Yeah.
But I think the only thing I would add to what John said was to add the T for time in there, really, because there's something about all of this, you know, which is also about a call to action or a call to do something rather than a sort of academic theoretical study of the interesting notion of, you know, role, relationship, relatedness, boundaries, you know, and hierarchies and leadership and those sorts of things. And because in a way, by the time we've worked out what's the best way to do it, it'll be a bit too late because of the climate change and all that's happening. So there's something about introducing there an urgency about getting the conversation out there and inviting people to join. And to some degree, that's about us doing things like this, which is, you know, getting out into conversations, into public spaces, and trying to engage people in some of these thoughts and some of these ideas so that, you know, there is something, a call to action, really. And I think that's the key bits. I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as an activist in the sense of, you know, gluing myself to roads or whatever, you know, manifestations you might see in a way, but I would, in other ways, say that, you know, I am an activist and I'm trying to mobilize and think together with people about doing something. I don't think that either of us or any of us would know quite what that looks like, other than if enough of us get together and want to have a think about what that might look like, then we might just come up with a few ideas.
Yeah. And you both draw on a long relationship. Did you both work at the Henderson together? Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
So for listeners, that the Henderson's a very famous therapeutic community in London, and I actually visited it. I worked in a therapeutic community in Liverpool with young people, and I went to visit the Henderson to kind of learn from the place, and it was just very, very interesting. What do you bring from that clinical kind of background to this idea of being unhoused, the unhoused mind? What kind of links have you made which kind of have enriched your way of thinking about this?
So the Henderson Hospital was sort of distinctively a democratic therapeutic community, where it was shared or appeared to be shared in ways that still do seem radical from some points of view. And I think it was informational for me in lots of ways, but I think what I would take from it is that gradually, and not immediately, but gradually, it taught me to jettison the word clinical, and to think, well, actually, these difficulties need not to be privatized off, split off into the clinic, and the clinical, These are psychosocial ailments. And you could sort of see that played out in an environment where in-group authorities, in that case, kind of clinical medical, abstained a little bit from, in some dimensions, from wielding itself too much. So that's the first thing, that the tendency always has been and still is to look at the unhoused minds and say, you're doing it deliberately, it's on you, could you just not be quite so troublesome, if you're going to rough sleep, could you not sleep in that doorway, you're doing it deliberately, you're making it up, you're being manipulative, you're attention seeking, you're a mass, you're a horde, do you see what I mean? It's all the unhoused minds, and our kind of call to arms is partly, and this very much arises, I think, out of the Henderson practice. Actually, can we look at the hospitality of the environment? What might make the so-called refusal to come in from the cold a very understandable, if not necessary and only move that a certain person could make in a particular circumstance? So kind of threads on LinkedIn recently about school refusal. And I sort of chipped in and said, well, the thing is, you see, why do we call it school refusal rather than looking at the state of the school? I think that doesn't just come from Henderson, but Henderson has thoughts about it. But it's sort of that conversation sort of began really with Henderson, and or was kind of crystallized, I think. So yes. Practices of equality, and this is a book that doesn't use any clinical terms to talk about trauma, exclusion, and violence. We careful to give a psychosocial account of what we mean by trauma. I think there's only one clinical term, and it's inverted commas, to lament that in 1980 we got lumbered with the term borderline personality disorder, and to hope that by 2030 we won't have it anymore. But other than that, this isn't a clinical book, though it does in some sense arise out of clinical practice, certainly in my case, I have a long NHS practice as a psychotherapist, but this is not.
I mean, what I would add to that, and for people that might be listening who are not familiar with it at all, is that the key to that particular way of working was that all of the conversations, one way or another, were in groups. And so from that point of view, in a way, the power was very much redistributed, or the attempts was to redistribute the power, and from, as it were, the idea of the expert clinician to involving people in very, very actively in as participants in their own lives and their own treatment, if you like, so that the people there were considered experts by experience. They knew about their lives, they knew about their experience, and that all being well, some of the staff that worked there might have known a little bit about how to run groups, but in a way, running groups is about as much as possible allowing the members of that groups to find their voice, mobilize their energies and enthusiasms. And of course, when you're working in groups where the patients outnumber the staff, as it were, hugely, and when you're thinking about the extent of the trauma and the disturbance, it's quite a courageous thing to do, both for the residents, and for the staff, because of course the residents are, one of the things is they're coming together with other people who are, as scared and as scary as they feel themselves to be scared and scary, to take the risk to be together and have conversations, and that, the staff's role, as much as anything else, is to try to keep out of the way as much as possible.
And that's a very, when you think about it, it's a very countercultural idea, and it's probably why these places got shut down, to focus on groups rather than kind of the individual is a huge kind of shift in thinking. I mean, everything is the individual these days. So it's very countercultural kind of position, isn't it?
Yeah, well, one of the things about that, in terms of the character, it did get closed down, sadly, and part of it was to do with discourses around what counted as evidence, So if you're doing like psychological evidence, with emphasis on the individual and their psychology, and you try to measure, have they improved on some measure or other, a psychological measure or other, you sort of miss something quite important about what they might not be any less miserable than they were in the first place, but that they somehow feel better able to inhabit their own bodies in a slightly different way, and live with other people in a slightly less damaged and less damaging way. And indeed, one of the bits of evidence that was most persuasive about Anderson at one point was an economic argument rather than a clinical psychological one, is that they quite simply they just added up all the amount of money that it cost the system, the world, the taxpayer, if you like, for this group of cohort of residents prior to going into treatment. And, you know, they were in prison, they were in hospitals, they were, you know, in all sorts of terrible states and costing the system a terrific amount of money. The treatment itself was quite expensive because it was residential. It was a year long. It, you know, involved staffing and, you know, accommodation and costs and everything. But then they followed a particular cohort afterwards to see how much money they were then costing the system afterwards, and found that it was a huge change. You know, that they were, you know, that the amount of money spent on not treating people, or not treating with the respect, or not engaging with them in some way, was enormous. And that if you did so, at the end of that, they cost, you know, the taxpayer a bit less money. And in a way, you know, there's something cynical about that. That in a way, it, one way or other, whether it's about psychology or money, it wasn't really about the welfare of the people in particular. Nobody really cared one way or the other about whether they were happy or unhappy. What they ended up caring about was it was a little bit cheaper for the rest of us. And but it was a persuasive argument, and it did mean that Anderson, you know, lasted for quite a long time. And then came the sort of backlash, which was again more individualism, more sort of return to the sort of psychology, more return to the expert psychotherapist or clinician, the three-letter acronyms, you know, was it a DBT or CBT or MBT and all of that stuff, which was all about the expertise of the therapist and nothing to do, you know, with the needs of the patient. And of course, if you know, this residents, as we call the patients, they were each other's therapists. This was the point about being in the groups. They knew best about what their lives and so on. And there was something about that in terms of the description of it as being a democratic therapeutic community that in a way we build on in the book and in our work together, you know, to really interrogate, you know, what might we mean by democratization of systems and redistribution of power, and thinking about something that's a bit more horizontal and a bit less vertical in the world. And of course, we haven't got that really. That's across the planet. That's why we're in such a mess. But, you know, but that's, I think that is the sort of radical edge, as you say, is that, you know, it's not exactly trust the group, but it is at least thinking that groups are more including, can accommodate trauma in better sorts of ways, and are less violating of people if they're set up well.
And if we could turn to your thinking about in groups and out groups, you mentioned early on, John, the housed unseat the unhoused. And that's a powerful kind of image. We often think of the homeless as people who have kind of fallen astray or something's happened to them, as if it's kind of arbitrary or unfortunate or some mental illness. But you're kind of shifting the that question. Do you want to say something about that?
I think we would say that something called the problem of homelessness is equivalent to something called the problem of migration or the problem of immigration. The language around human mobility has sort of collapsed so that suddenly it's illegal to be a migrant, and there's an illegal migrant bill going through this country's parliament. And this is a nonsense. It's not illegal. It can't be illegal to be on the move. However, the what we would in our analysis, we would say, I'm sure not many people ever have said this, but in our analysis, we would say, well, actually, we, the in-group, have been making some others of we into an out-group and then penalizing them for being on the move for a very, very, very long time. Marx would say, we say this in the book, Marx would say, well, we enclosed the land and turfed the people off the land and then made it illegal to be homeless. And you know, he quotes kind of three strikes and you're outlawed. You could be executed as an enemy of the commonweal if you were able-bodied and couldn't show that you knew your place. Mm-hmm. There's the sociological fact of dispossession, not having a fixed abode, being criminalized by the housed.
Yeah.
But then also the psychological, but we would prefer to say, I think, the sort of psychosocial, the phenomenology of feeling and being disrespected, dismissed, not accommodated, not welcomed. So it's kind of what's it like? We might know something about it, but we're not trying to say that we know something about it. What's it like to not have a place to belong, to have nowhere to go and nowhere to turn to? And can we notice that the problem of homelessness is being securitized by the housed, because we, the housed, don't want to be reminded of privilege, or don't want to be reminded of who we displaced to have our housing, you know, be that bricks and mortar or, I don't know, our trust fund or whatever. So can we notice the power play wherein just sort of claiming our settledness and building a wall around our community unhouses and displaces people? Not to get completely lost in this, but as the Henderson did, you know, the Henderson brought people into residence created a pathway for people to bring themselves into residence, I should properly say. There were so many people that I didn't manage to clear a path for, to accommodate. And it's the forgotten, invisible displaced that we're trying to keep our focus on. And so, I don't know, to take something from today's paper, William Windsor has sort of announced a 3 million fund to end street homelessness. You know, you can't say that the 3 million won't be welcomed, though he could possibly give up a bit more. But you can say that we have been seeing moves to end homelessness ever since I was working hostels in the early 90s in the Rough Sleepers Initiative. And so ever since then, but I'm sure since before then as well, before Kathy come home and before everything, let's end homelessness, right? But since we keep generating homelessness, we, the in-group, we, the housed, this is a long way of answering your question, we, the housed, keep generating homelessness. We keep unseating people and unsettling people. So I think we shouldn't be allowed off the hook of hang on, before you start rehousing a few people, which is great. We're rehousing a few people, mm-hmm. but how many are we displacing?
Yeah.
Just to end on what I hope is an obvious point, that those 600, 700 people that drowned off the coast of Greece last week, we displaced them.
Yeah.
So this analysis of in-groups, and I hope it's sort of clear in what I'm saying, that the sort of, let's look at that through the lens of in-groups and out-groups and what's happening at the intersection, because it illuminates that unhousing is a gerund, that somebody is doing something to someone there.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to get hold of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very helpful. You also, in the book, you talk about the Diogenes paradigm. Do you want to say something about that, Chris? Have I pronounced it right?
So I would pronounce it, but I wasn't living at that time to know how he pronounced it.
I've often been uneasy about that, whether we are pronouncing it right. So
I mean, we draw on stories, really, because I think that, you know, there's something about stories and metaphor in this that we've found in mainly talking about and presenting it, where, you know, if you tell a story that engages people a little bit, then somehow the concepts get a bit easier to digest, and that we had a shared interest, really, in and the idea of Diogenes. And Diogenes was a ancient Greek. I mean, the story is he was born in a quite a privileged place in terms of his family and so on. You know, he was well educated in the academy and lived in Sinope with his family. But at that time, where they lived was it was a colony of the empire of Philip and Alexander the Great. So that in a way, he was a colonized person, but he did quite well out of there, his father did. But that somehow his positioning even then was that he somehow didn't quite know how to be colonized. And so as the story goes, that he and his father were involved in some counterfeiting in terms of the currency, shaving a bit of precious metals off the edge of the coins or doing something, which you could say was a way of corrupting the currency. You could say the history of where they were living, rather than theft, as it were. They were just spoiling the currency and doing something. Anyway, they got caught. So and Diogenes sort of hoofed it off and became one of the sort of archetypal homeless, manic street preachers, philosophers wandering about the world, waving his stick around and trying to sort of invite people to sort of think about stuff. But and that he was as a philosopher, because he was well educated, he became understood to be. He was always associated with dogs. That was the other bit. So partly he's always surrounded by dogs, and. In his one of the main stories was he used to live, took up his abode he's homeless, but he took up his abode, his bash, if you like, in a barrel in the middle of the market square in Athens in Greece, and to some degree took up his abode in the middle of the square, because on the one hand he couldn't belong to a society that he felt was just intrinsically hypocritical. So people, he became quite popular. People said, come in, have a bite to eat with us, Diogenes, or whatever it is. Well, I can't join your slave-owning, hypocritical, colonizing society. But nor do I dislike you enough to go away. So I'm going to find a place for myself to be, and that the place is going to be smack bang in the middle of your agora, the marketplace, where I will inhabit myself on a borderline in this barrel, where I'm neither in nor out. So I can't go away and I can't come in. And from this position, I'm surrounded by dogs and living in his barrel. There's all sorts of stories about his life we could go into and describe a few of them. But he became quite celebrated as a manic street preacher, if you like, a philosopher. And because he was always surrounded by dogs, he gave coined, the idea was that his philosophy became dogged or dog-like. Mm-hmm. And so he became a cynic philosopher. And so in a way, Diogenes was one of the original cynics.
Yeah.
And if you think about cynicism in the way in which, that word, even as a language, got corrupted now into something like sarcasm or destructiveness, the way in which Diogenes took up his position, neither in nor out, being critical and concerned for humanity, his cynicism was a profoundly important philosophical, dog-like, dogged position. But perhaps the most interesting story that we use, so how is it that you can inhabit a place where you're neither in nor out, you live on the borderline, it's a painful place, you're not happy, you can't be in, you can't be out, you're surrounded by dogs, you're living in a barrel amongst your excrement and all the rest of it, but this is where you belong, this is the only place you belong, this is where you take your stand, and do so in a way that's sort of courageous. And so he for us stood as a sort of third position, if you like, which is neither in nor out, and both in and out. And cynical and concerned for humanity. And perhaps, I guess it would be true to say that Dalgliesh wasn't necessarily concerned about anybody in particular. You know, he was quite concerned about people in general, but and humanity, but not necessarily anybody in particular. But the most celebrated story of Diogenes that we use in the book was about his relationship to power and authority. And there was one occasion where Alexander the Great, who was then the most powerful man in the world, who had colonized the whole of the world and wept because there were no more kingdoms to conquer, came to I'm not quite sure, Athens or Corinth or whatever it became, and threw a party. And you know, so Alexander the Great throws a party and invites everybody who's anybody, because everybody, you know, not so much because he wants to share, you know, his wealth with them. He just wants people to know how great he is.
Yeah.
And he too was an educated man educated in the academy and so on. So on this occasion, everybody who's anybody is invited to his party. And so everybody did go, because of course Alexander was very bloodthirsty and very famous for not tolerating dissent particularly well. He just tended to sort of cut people's heads off or whatever it was. So everybody did go to this party, except of course Diogenes, who was invited, but he didn't go. Which of course is a very dangerous thing to do, because you know, he risked the wrath of Alexander. And Alexander had never had this happen to him before, that someone doesn't go to his party. So he popped along to see him in his barrel in the market square, and the exchange was, well, you know, look, and it's reported that they had a chat and they got to like each other. And you know, one version was that they wanted quite similar things. Diogenes wanted sort of love in a peaceful world of democracy and equality, and Alexander wanted love in a peaceful world that he was in charge of. You know, so they had a sort of shared interest in love in a peaceful world, different means of achieving it. And so it's reported that they got to know each other a little bit in this conversation, liked each other. And so Alexander said, all right, now enough of this. You know, I'm the most powerful man in the world. I like you. You're an intelligent, thoughtful bloke. You're living in a barrel. So there must be something I can do to help you. To which Diogenes says, yeah, there is. You can just move out of the way because you're blocking my sunlight. And of course, here, Diogenes' position was something about help and how it's offered.
Yeah.
And from whom it's offered. And so the way in which we use the story is, you know, what's it like to be in Diogenes' shoes is one question. But also, what's it like to be in Alexander's shoes when you think you can help somebody who's homeless and unengaged on your terms? Me, I am Alexander. I am the outreach worker. I can help you, but don't be, you know, on my terms, because I know what help you need. And the answer is, yeah, there is. Let's just go away. You know, yeah. What do you do? You know, what do you do? And so we use this sort of metaphor and narrative and story to try and, as a Diogenes paradigm, to try and think about relationships between, as it were, people who seem to be have no power whatsoever, and people who seem to have lots of power, and realizing that if you then were to interrogate that a bit more closely, and what do we mean by power?
Yeah.
You know, what do you mean by authority? You know, who was the most powerful person in that exchange?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it, Diogenes in his barrel, or was it Alexander standing outside it? And so we then sort of use it to try and interrogate this question about the in-group and the out-group and the relationship between them, and use various examples. Rosa Parks as another one.
Yeah.
You know, about, you know, she was expected to sort of get up out of her seat, to because she wasn't a black woman, wasn't allowed to sort of sit up on the seat in the bus, and she refused. And so, you know, what does it mean to go along with stuff, and what does it mean to not go along with stuff?
Yeah.
And I guess our invitation is to think more about not going along with stuff so much. And in that way, Diogenes and various other examples that we use in the book that were a bit Diogenistic help us to sort of think about leadership and authority and power in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. I mean, I'm working at the moment with Save the Children and the Humanitarian Leadership Academy. I've just been running a course this morning for kind of 40 leaders from all over the world, from Sudan, and like working with the dispossessed, the most precarious, you know, and these questions are absolutely fundamental, you know, in the sector around kind of what kind of aid are we offering? What kind of help are we offering? Is it salvation aid? You know, and how can you kind of make this a more mutual, more democratic kind of a way of working, this kind of idea of power? So these ideas are absolutely central to the work we're trying to do. And as we know, with climate change, there's going to be a lot more homelessness, a lot more migration. This precarious kind of world is going to kind of increase the need to reflect on these questions, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think we've got sometimes talk about, and it's kind of to jargonize it a bit, but I'll explain why I'm saying this. We sometimes talk about a forensic psychosocial studies. And I guess we hope that if the book and our work generally offers a line on things, an angle that might open things up rather than close things down, it is that if we take a psychosocial lens to these encounters between in-groups and out-groups and the power relations that emerge, if we look at them through this lens, that's forensic in the sense that it illuminates where the offending might be. Here is a story, here's a vignette, here's an encounter, Alexander and Diogenes, or that bus driver in Rosa Parks, or whichever it is. And if you look at it through this lens, that it's not an individual violence that emerges to be in forensic means of the forum, right? So it comes into the forum or the marketplace or the agora to be examined and taken up. What emerges is the structural violence.
Yeah.
And so we both have connections to kind of forensic settings within the NHS, but here the forensic is, well, can we sort of stop sort of splitting it off into this or that place, into agoras that turn out not to be agoras, like kind of walking through a kind of hostel in Rwanda and saying, oh, fantastic place for our exports to land. But in fact, of course, the place has been cleared and the homeless people living in that hostel were shunted off to hundreds of miles, so they were out of the way of the cameras. So that looks like an agora, but it's not an agora, right?
Yeah.
But less forensically, get this into the agora, what we have done to contribute to that, and perhaps we can just notice this long pattern of criminalizing the vagabond, and a vagabond just means having no settled home.
Yes.
But it's become the very worst thing you could, a vagabond, the very worst thing you could be, and there's an awful echo of the middle passage in the intersection, like in say 100 years ago, if you looked at a sort of medical dictionary, although it's a misuse of the name medical really, but if you looked in a medical dictionary, you'd find drapetomania, the crazy idea that you should run away from your slavery, very linked to vagabondage, the sort of insane restlessness is a sort of where the two terms intersect, and there's awful echoes of the middle passage in the way those people, those vagabonds, were packed in to the hold of that ship that sank. Yeah. And so that's a sort of maybe a forensic illumination of some stuff that's going on that we are privy to and party to, and don't have any time to do anything now but stop.
Yeah. This has been a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much for coming to the end of the podcast. I ask guests at the end of the podcast to reflect on two questions, what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. I'm going to ask Chris, have you got any thoughts on what it means to live a good life? And John, what it means to create a good society? Big questions.
John, go for society first.
Well, yes, thank you, Simon. I mean, I appreciate it's a really important question to ask. This is what kind of Diogenes went around asking in a way, isn't it?
But yes, it is. Yeah.
But I, I'll try and answer as long as you don't take me as kind of pronouncing as if I know.
None of us know. We just throw it out there.
One of the things that's becoming, but it feels like it's becoming clearer to me, is that power sharing moves, which includes the Henderson Hospital Democratic Therapeutic Community and all sorts of other things that look like very good ideas. Power sharing moves are ways of holding on to power. Let's co-produce this. We'll run something up the flagpole and see if you salute, and then we'll call that co-production. And not to get lost in this because we're closing the podcast, but I think the creative possibilities giving up power are going to have to be some part of how we as a species could possibly make accommodation for each other as the waters rise. It's easier said than done, and I haven't quit my day job yet, so open to the charge of hypocrisy. But I think that practices of equality, getting out more, looking at your own power and positioning and what you can this be relinquished now, that would be some part of it.
Thank you, John. That's very helpful. Any thoughts, Chris?
A couple, I think. I think living a good life, as it were. In the last chapter of the book, one of the things that we write about, which is connected to a story about Diogenes, is about disappointment. And that we talk about one story about Diogenes was he was seen, it was part of his cynical position, and he was seen begging from a statue in the agora, in front of the temple. Mm-hmm. And someone asked him, it's something like, Diogenes, what are you doing begging from a statue? And he said, well, I'm practicing disappointment. And in the last chapter of the book, we interrogate this question about what would it be like to practice disappointment? Would that allow for the possibility of a living a better life, I suppose, in terms of your question? Because in a way, disappointment, I think, is a sort of almost a throwaway word in a way. I feel disappointed, or I'm disappointed in you, or you've, whatever it happens to be. But to think, that there is something necessary about disappointment. If you think about, well, what appointment did you set yourself in the first place? What were you appointed to do? And, what is the illusion, if you like? So the link between illusion, disillusionment and disappointment is, I guess, the invitation is for us all to think how very disappointing and disappointed we might all be, as a way of really thinking together about the alternatives. And so one of the things we sort of invite us to engage, with is a real sense of what does it mean to be disappointed, and what is disappointment, and how do we really engage with it? Because somewhere it's in the back of everybody's mind, something like that anyway. And so that was one thought, which is in the book. The other bit that comes to mind was a phrase you use, T.S. Eliot, which links to it a bit, which is he, in one of his plays, he says, we're all dreaming of systems so perfect that no one needs to be good. And I suppose, and of course it was a critique, is that there are no perfect systems. And so dreaming of perfect systems is a way of avoiding dealing with the anxiety of things not being very good. So I guess the invitation is to think things aren't very good, and that's very disappointing. And the answer is not to dream of perfect systems, but to really try to together, to think about how very disappointing humankind is and has been. And some of us, I guess, depending on our positioning within the hierarchy of privileges, particularly you might say people like us, white men, might be, the ones who might be invited to do that a bit sooner than others.
Very good. Very thoughtful. I've really enjoyed your conversation. Thank you both very much. And I hope to see you along the road. group relations conference or whatever. Go well. Thank you again.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
All right.